Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast and the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement. Today, I will give a viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics in which we will be discussing. Whenever I say we, I am very excited to welcome my friend, my new friend, and my incredible friend now, super excited to welcome Lacey Bond to the podcast. Hello, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm doing great. I actually got to give a consent talk at a spicy party last night, which was really fun.
Oh, hell. Well, this conversation is going to be spicy too, because we're going to be talking about the differences and similarities between purity culture versus rape culture. Because unfortunately, they're very connected. It is very tied to evangelical. It is very tied to deep religious. It is tied directly to generational trauma. How do we as a society recognize the difference in the similarities, which unfortunately, there's a lot more similarities based on what I've researched and based on what I know about it?
You don't
There's a
even
lot.
differentiate.
Yeah.
They're the same.
Yes.
Purity culture is rape culture, and I am happy to expound on that. But yeah, so oh, where do you want me to start? Oh, you all should start a little bit about me, huh? That's how a podcast intro works. So I go by at Intimacy Lacey online. I am a certified sex, relationship, and intimacy coach, as well as being a sex and kink educator. I work a lot with purity culture survivors, the post-purity crowd, I like to call it. I also work with a lot of people who are in like second adolescence, people who are coming out a little later in life, having a lot of those experiences that are often also purity culture survivors because that cadre of people isn't really given a developmentally appropriate container or safe space in which to explore their own sexuality and personhood when they're younger. So it ends up happening, when we're in our 30s. I also work a lot with and in the kink and polyamorous communities. We have a running joke here in Los Angeles that the Venn diagram of those two communities is a circle, and stacked on top of that is like the Ren Faire community and the Dungeons and Dragons and live action role play community for various reasons, but there is a lot of overlap. Between the two, both in communities and in folks who identify as, being polyamorous, often are also into BDSM. Not always. That one's, I guess, not quite a circle, but it's probably like a big overlap. I don't know why I'm gesticulating with my hands. I talk with my hands, but this is an audio medium, so just imagine me gesticulating like an Italian man, despite the fact that I am like not. I'm like English German descent.
I'm sitting over here. Just gosh, this is going to be such a good conversation because you said it very well that purity culture is rape culture, and there's not a whole lot of similarities. I know there's a little bit, but whenever you look at it as a patriarchal system and a patriarchal society, like it's really one and the same. So I would love for you just to do a deep dive into, and let's kind of like break this apart. So let's talk about purity culture, and then we'll bring in rape culture here in just a little bit. But let's talk about that purity culture and what you have seen in people that you talk to or things that you've discussed, or just walk us through what you're thinking.
Yeah, so I will explain what purity culture even is. Purity culture is a semi-religious, cultural, and societal movement. There's a very broad definition, which emphasizes sexual abstinence and puts extreme importance on virginity and sexual restrictions. It has the current version, because this is not entirely unique to like American evangelicalism, but what I work with and what is the most prevalent has roots in mid-century American evangelical Christian teachings. You can trace a lot of what people today talk about as purity culture. You can trace that to the True Love Waits campaign, which a youth pastor from Florida, I believe, of course, Richard Ross, fuck you, guy, launched in 1993 with a mission for participants to abstain from, and this is a direct quote, sexual thoughts, sexual touching, pornography, and actions that are known to lead to sexual arousal. And this was a campaign that was targeted at teenagers. The first True Love Waits pledges were signed by teenage members of his youth group. And that campaign claims that around 2.5 million teens and young adults joined between 1993 and 2004, signing the pledge, wearing purity rings to signal their commitment to abstinence in pursuit of righteousness and healthy marriages later in life. Because the idea is that if you save yourself for marriage, you will have a better relationship because you won't have imprinted on a previous sexual partner. You won't have a frame of reference to compare your future spouse to, which as a relationship professional, the three biggest axes of what's the word? Compatibility. And the three biggest stressors in marriages are sex, children, and finances. So it is actually completely valid to engage or not engage in a relationship based on compatibility of one of those factors, including sexual compatibility. So that's something that is really missing from sexuality education in general, but particularly is really quashed in purity culture. So I was part of this movement. I was born in the early 90s. I got my first purity ring. I want to say in the early 2000s, I was maybe 11. I did not know what sex was for sure. And the abstinence-only sex ed provided by my Christian elementary and high schools was not particularly illuminating. I recall a sex ed module in my Lutheran high school because I went to Christian school my entire life, including graduating from Biola University. Which, if you are not evangelical, I will inform you is one of the three most conservative schools in the country, only surpassed by Bob Jones and Liberty University. And one of the folks in my family is also a graduate of Liberty. That one is even worse than Biola in terms of general repression. but this module in high school was like, and this is a Christian high school, small town. I'm from a rural area, and so we had this video that was very much that Mean Girls moment of like, if you have sex, you will get pregnant and you will die. But it was, if you have gay sex, you will get HIV/AIDS and you will die. Which HIV and AIDS are no longer death sentences. There are many medications that people can take to both prevent contracting life-threatening STIs and also to manage severe STIs. PrEP is a thing for that. I don't work a lot in the like STI prevention space, but it is worth mentioning that a lot of STIs are really common. That is sexually transmitted infections. We use that language a lot more now than we use sexually transmitted diseases. I don't recall the particulars of why, but it's kind of that language shift came around the same time that sex educators shifted from saying safe sex to safer sex, because it's more about risk mitigation rather than an entire removal of risk, which is ostensibly what abstinence-only sex ed and the purity culture True Love Waits campaign try to do. Well, if you don't have any sex at all ever, you'll never get an STI, or you'll never get pregnant, and you know. Saving yourself for marriage is no guarantee that you won't contract an STI because there's no guarantee that your partner does not have an STI or isn't fucking around on you and might not bring something home to you. so I think I actually learned the mechanics of sex reading like erotic fan fiction as a teen, you know, years after I had gotten a purity ring. And I was struggling like immensely with the feelings of like sin and shame that this brought on because I was very much the good Christian girl, super devout, super indoctrinated, did not question much outside of the evangelical Christian framework. And I did study the Bible a lot, which is part of what led to my deconstruction post college, because when you go to Biola, you actually are required to get a minor in biblical studies. And this is a school whose tuition is $50,000 a year now. I think it was 35 or 40 grand when I graduated. So that's 30 credits of Bible. That's an entire year worth of credits and tuition that is required. So I actually have, fortunately or unfortunately, a really strong background in biblical scholarship. And I'm trying to remember the word. There's a word for when you interpret scripture. I usually can remember this word. There's some neural pathways that have been paved over. It's not eschatology. Eschatology is the study of the end times, which is how you know I went to Christian college. I know that word. Or maybe I was in a cult. Cults know that one too. But I was definitely super in that world. But the big thing about purity culture, it teaches people that, especially women, that preserving virginity until marriage is one of the most important things they must do to be good Christians, and that sexual sin is worse than other sins, which is not really that doctrinally sound. That's based more on puritanical mores than it is on like a decent reading of and like a contextualized reading of scripture, but that's neither here nor there. That's just what they do. It's very important to like not have sex, and that refraining from it ensures a healthy married relationship. So you're all expected to maintain sexual purity until marriage, but the responsibility falls heavily on women who are generally framed as lacking any sexual desire of their own. Their positions, not just as stewards of their own sexual purity, but that of the boys and men around them. And conversely, men are expected to fail in their pursuit of preserving their own purity until marriage, because they're basically taught that they are inherently more sexual and more lustful. It's expected that they will engage in sex, masturbate, use pornography, get addicted to pornography. I'm on a tangent. We can come back to this. I don't, and most sex therapists and coaches do not endorse the idea of porn and sex addiction. We typically talk about it in terms of one, it doesn't behave like addiction. Justin J. Lehmiller, a really prominent sexologist, has several podcast episodes on this, and he does a phenomenal job deep diving. Because calling it addiction just really compounds the shame, and it's really more about compulsive sexual behaviors or moral incongruence. Because something interesting to note about the idea of porn addiction is that men who self-report porn addiction actually consume less of it than the general population. They just feel worse about it because they are taught that, all extramarital sex is bad, but like it's this weird, but you're expected to like fall and like fail in this. So when I was at Biola, I actually attended numerous chapels because we had a chapel requirement. I think we had to go to 30 in a semester, maybe 20. I don't recall. There was literally a fine if you don't go to all of them. It's like $375 now. You can make them up by listening to the chapel services and then filling out a form, chapel makeups afterwards. But we had to go to a lot of chapels, and there were quite a few of them dedicated to male lust and porn use or addiction. And there was one that focused on women and female sexuality. It was held in like a smaller women's chapel service. And I remember because at the time I was writing a kind of like a undergrad thesis. We called it a capstone project. It's meant to like bring your whole university education together. And I decided that in my assignment to explore a counterculture point of view, that instead of expressing a Christian point of view contrasted against the broader secular culture, I was like, well, I think that it's a problem that the church is so sex negative. Actually, I think it's doing a disservice to women. Like, we never talk about this, and like it's it I don't see a lot of support for this in the text or in historical explorations of the text. I mean, the two, like, I can do a theological deep dive later, but like the final thesis I was working on, basically undergrad thesis. This is not like a master's thesis, but it focused on how sex negativity is not biblically sound and harms women in a way that contradicts our nature as creations of a loving God. In purity culture, women are typically presented as objects of potential lust, often requiring like strict modesty and sex-based segregation to preserve both their virtue and present men or boys. And like, I do mean men or boys around them from stumbling or being tempted into sin or sinful thoughts. Because even as like a minor girl, whether you're a teenager or younger, there's this fear that like you might dress a certain way and you might cause a Christian man to stumble or cause your brother in Christ to stumble. And they never talked about the converse, which is one of the things that bugged me, because at Biola, like I would be watching the men's cross country team like run their drills across campus and they're wearing like nothing but the tiny short shorts. And I'm like, okay, I can't wear spaghetti straps because it might like a guy might think about the fact that I have boobs, but these fools are out here in basically underwear. And like you just think like, what if they caused me to stumble? Is no one going to talk to them about how they're responsible for my sexual behavior and thoughts? Because I definitely got talked to a lot. And a lot of the other girls around me got talked to a lot, either directly or in books and chapels and teachings, that like it was our responsibility to keep other people, other men and boys, from sinning. There's a book called Pure by Linda K. Klein. She wrote, Pure Inside the Evangelical Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. She expressed it super well. Men are taught their minds are evil, whereas women are taught that their bodies are evil. And it's just very heavily focused on preserving virginity and restricting your sexual knowledge and experience, ostensibly to keep you safe or maintain, biblical marriage, which Solomon had 1,000 wives and concubines. That's in the Bible. So I don't know where people are getting the idea that biblical marriage is a monogamous heterosexual situation. There's a lot of stuff about biblical marriage and marriage covenants that is absolutely not present in our current society. And there's something I cited once that then Vice President Mike Pence claimed that he would not dine alone with any woman except his wife, or attend events that serve alcohol without her. And to me, this really typifies this purity culture. I believe Pence is an evangelical Christian, but like women are framed as potential objects of lust, and men are expected to avoid them if necessary to preserve their integrity or keep their lustful minds from wandering. It's a super unhealthy mental dynamic for any gender. And a lot of times when we talk about purity culture, we talk about how it affects women, but it does really fuck up men as well. And there's a lot of objectification that comes along with it for girls in particular. So there's a myriad of object lessons or analogies that we would get taught, and that were really fun, like to basically illustrate what happens to you if you have sex, as a teenager or before you're like ready to commit to someone for marriage for your entire life, which is like, well, it's like, you're a chewed up piece of gum, and like no one wants to chew a piece of gum that's already been chewed. Or they would like open up an Oreo cookie and like lick the inside and put it back together and basically say like, this is what it's like after you've like given your virginity to someone. Or one particular object lesson that I had in youth group was that our youth pastors glued a couple pieces of construction paper together, like let it sit for a minute, and then just like ripped them apart so that you could see the like pieces of paper that are, still stuck to each other, to illustrate like what happens when you like form, a close intimate bond with someone, and then like you break up, which that's not really how what having sex does to you as a person. But there's often like this bubble where there's very little framework outside of it. But what happens is like, if you're so focused on keeping your virginity until marriage, the expectation in this culture is that once a couple marries, they're expected to basically just be able to start having enjoyable sex. It's like a prize for having made it that far as a virgin. Like, purity culture really idolizes virginity in a way that's just crazy. Because it simultaneously fetishizes and demonizes sex. Well, it's like, don't have sex because it's bad. It's a sin, you'll go to hell. It's bad, it's a sin, you'll go to hell. Oh, you're married, flip the switch. It's good. It's actually part of a good, like, wholesome, God-granted, blessed Christian marriage union. But it results in a crazy cognitive dissonance because when people, even when they do follow all the rules and refrain from all sexual activity and thoughts for as best they can, which is terrible for your psyche because sexual thoughts are really normal to have and developmentally appropriate. They get married, but they still experience like anxiety or terror or shutdown around the idea of sex or arousal because for years you've identified those things with temptation, sin, and in most cases, eternal damnation, which I can tangent about how the idea of an eternal conscious hell is actually also not biblically supported. But yeah, it basically just turns sex into this crazy, scary idol thing that is very difficult for anyone to engage with. And often people are not given any type of sex education, let alone developmentally appropriate sex education, because it's usually happening in subcultures, religious or not, where talking about sex at all is taboo, and they're afraid that talking about it is gonna like give a kid ideas, or lead them down a path to sensation, or be like lead them to risk. When actually the reality is, if you teach a child developmentally age appropriate terms for their own body and like what is safe and expected, it actually enables them to flag when something is not right. It allows them to express and articulate if someone does violate their bodily sovereignty and does touch them in a specific area. If they have the name for the area, they can say, so and so, did something to me. They touched me here. They wanted to touch me here. It was weird. I didn't like it. But if you completely remove any type of language about sex and sexuality, that doesn't happen. So I talk a lot about the True Love Waits movement. It is, obviously broader than that. It has a lot of roots that go, deeper into decades and centuries of sexual repression, especially in America. But a big part of why I talk about purity culture being rape culture is that you are not taught that your body is your own and that you are the only person who can grant access to it. They will talk about consent and like not, giving yourself to someone else, but it's always paired with this idea that you're saving yourself for your spouse. And it might have been in Josh Harris's I Kissed Dating Goodbye, which he has since retracted after damaging millions and millions of people during its publication run, where it might have been that book or some other comparable book where it talks about like a groom being at the altar and like his bride like comes up and is like so happy to see him, but then like to his right there's like all these girls, and she's like, who is this? He's like, and like I don't know, there's some fever dream that someone made up, or it could be some repressed like anxiety episode that someone actually had. I fortunately never read I Kissed Dating Goodbye. I'm gonna read it at some point for research, but I'm gonna have to be so fortified for that experience. But basically, like, she gets to the altar and her groom's got all these other girls, like, standing to his side, and it's like all of his exes that he's ever slept with because they're still part of him or something. It positions anything outside of just the tiny, narrow sliver of only having heterosexual intercourse with your monogamous spouse as aberrant. And so you pair that with the general lack of any conversation around sex, or what conversation does happen, it's very restricted and it is abstinence-based. It leads to people just thinking that all kinds of super normal human sexual desires or thoughts are aberrant and wrong and bad. And so people who come from purity culture have a really pronounced sense of shame and a really pronounced lack of ability. I don't want to say complete inability, but a lack of ability to feel okay in their own body and presence. So now that I've explained more or less what purity culture is, I want to dive into like specifically some of the more, I want to dive into more of the specifics on why I do maintain it is purity culture is rape culture. Zach, do you have any questions now that I've rage dumped for like 15 minutes?
15, that's like 20.
I have no idea. I blacked out. I lost track of how much time I was talking for.
That's perfectly fine. I think people that are listening, they're used to these unhinged rants. They're used to unscripted, they're used to the unfiltered. And that's part of what sets this podcast different from others, because I don't do a lot of editing, and there's a reason for that. Because I believe in the holistic voice and bringing these voices together to advocate against these patriarchal systems and the systems that are silencing you. And I have a really, I'm trying to think of the best way to word this. And, feel free to call me out however you want to do this. But growing up in the culture itself, okay, so growing up in like this purity culture, I mean, I guess technically we all really are, if you want to
Yeah, but
be, if you
this
want to be technical. But what was it that got you into doing like this work? I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this, because I'm trying not to, I'm trying to do it in a really good way that it makes the most sense. But I can imagine growing up, you're forced to understand these, you're forced to recognize these, but then you come out against those. Like, what was that like? I guess it's kind of like a awakening or like an aha moment. Like, this is actually a bullshit culture. I mean, like, I'm just wondering what that transition was like for you.
For me, it's never just like one aha moment. If I had to pick an aha moment, it would be post-college reading the term purity culture for the first time and everything clicking into place and why everything felt sideways. Because as a teenager, I had, and I guess probably still have, like a higher libido, but no one ever would talk about the fact that girls experience sexual desire. So in that absence, like we would talk about boys experiencing it all the time. Like I remember one time in a like high school home youth group with some of our youth pastors, not the ones who did the construction paper, but different ones. But I think the question was asked, like, is it true like boys think about sex like every 7 seconds, which is a bullshit statistic. That's not a real thing. But like one of the high school boys was like, oh yeah, all the time. And I remember who it was. But no one ever talked about female desire. I think probably that chapel at Biola was one of the first ones. But as a teenager, I'm like, okay, well, like I'm having feelings. And no one's really like, I'm not like, this is just like kind of a big absence, the big void was how I described it when I was doing my work at Biola. And so for me, it was noticing that there's, how do I articulate this? I've struggled to articulate it, but basically noticing the incongruence around how focused we were on like male sexuality, which again, American culture tends to anyway, because we do have a puritanical heritage in this country. But it was that it was there's like a gender communication class I took at Biola that kind of introduced the idea of rape culture. They actually talked about it, this idea that like it could, it's, I mean, to define rape culture, like it could happen at any time, slut shaming, it can be framed as your fault. That class also had the concept that gender is a social construct, which is sh shocking, honestly, in retrospect, that a super conservative Christian college would endorse that, but it was one of the like top communication professors that we had. But there's a little bit of that. There's like these sprinklings that come throughout my frustration at like, seeing the men's cross country team while we've got all kinds of rules about what the girls can wear and not being in, opposite sex dorms, et cetera, et cetera. And frustrations that I had when I was trying to research like basic sexual health information, like something was going on vaginally, and I was like trying to like Google it, and the school's got like net nanny software that's not allowing me to access like health information. Like, I don't need to go to a doctor for this. Like, I just need to Google some info. It was that. It was once I was off campus, I think I found a sex positive video series, and this is when I discovered the term sex positivity, which is basically just like the concept that having sex and wanting it is an okay and healthy, normal part of being a human, which is not what purity culture teaches you. It basically teaches you that it's bad and evil and wrong, except if you're married, then it's okay for some reason. But I'd found this educational video series that was hosted by Nina Hartley, who is like an OG porn star, just educational, like fully clothed, just kind of clinically engaging, talking about some of the mechanics of sex and like sexual health and like all this stuff. And I was like, this is so fascinating. As someone who, actually had been like fairly fascinated with sex, especially since it was so like taboo. It's just like all of these pieces over, the course of years through high school and college, and starting to deconstruct, like, hey, like this isn't like super biblical, to my eyes as someone who's, been in Christian school my whole life, studied the Bible deeply, and realizing, and things like, the science of birth control not lining up with what I had been taught that it was, because contraception is also typically not spoken of or accepted in purity culture. And pregnancy is also this weird thing where it's like, well, if you have sex, you'll get pregnant, and that's the punishment. Like, you'll end up pregnant, which is just a great thing to instill young people with, is that like the idea of pregnancy and parenthood is punitive. But just kind of over the course of years at Biola, just kind of realizing like, I think it's actually okay to be the way that I am. Oh, this is really normal. And then after graduating, I think I was reading articles on like patheos.com, which is a really great philosophy and religion and comparative and skeptic and like all this stuff, a website. Lots of really good pieces where I encountered the term purity culture for the first time. And I was like, oh, this is, all of this makes sense. I didn't know there was a term for this. I thought it was just the way you were supposed to be. And then shortly after that, like after college, it was actually an episode of The Boys that really, really got me. It was like The Boys on Amazon Prime, because there's an episode where one of the main characters, Starlight, the blonde girl in the white costume, she goes to a Christian festival and she's asked to speak to a group of teens about abstinence. And there's like a circle of them in this big church tent. And the youth pastor is like leading the thing, and they're like, oh my God, we have Starlight here. Like, 'cause she grew up on this like festival circuit doing like, if you're not familiar with boys, this is gonna sound wild. It's like superhero beauty pageant circuit. And so everybody knew who she was. And one of the girls was like, oh my God, Starlight, like, is it hard to like stay a virgin? Like, when you're like so like big celebrity and all this stuff. And like, you see in Starlight's face, and she's just like, oh shit, I gotta lie. I got a lot of this group of kids. The youth pastor's like staring her dead in the eyes, like, you know what you're supposed to say. I don't give a fuck what your experience actually is. You need to tell these kids that they need to stay virgins. And so, like, she does. And, like, immediately afterwards, she has this full, like, just this is all bullshit. Like, she, like, goes up on stage and, like, does not follow the script and, like, calls everybody out for being full of shit. It's great. But I was like, oh, I was one of those teenagers. Oh, it's like the completion of the full circle. Like, this is some bullshit. And I think that was probably, a decade after, like as a teenager, like, having initial, like, developmentally appropriate, like, sexual feelings and like libido awakening and stuff, because you're a teenager and your hormones are happening. So that was probably the like aha moment for me, like the biggest one, where I was just like, okay, you know what? I'm done. And during that time, I was also constructing from deconstructing, I should say, from the religion overall, because I'm no longer of the faith. But basically, like the shortest version of expressing like how my deconstruction happened was I basically discovered female sexual liberation. And that was a big piece of like untangling and unwinding and examining the text and its context, using the skills that I was taught in my evangelical upbringing and education, ironically. So yeah, I wish I like I like I don't know if I wish that there was like one turning point, but there's not just one. It's the same thing with like realizing something is abusive. It's not usually one thing. It's usually like a lot of little things, and then finally there's a straw that breaks the camel's back. But it was during this time that getting into purity culture, being rape culture, is that I discovered the story of Elizabeth Smart. She was, I think, 12 or 14. She was a kidnapping and sexual assault survivor, and she had encountered specifically the chewed up piece of gum comparison. And during her captivity, there were times, as a teenager, there were times where she could have escaped, but she specifically referenced this. Like, this is a direct quote from her. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm that chewed up piece of gum. Nobody rechews a piece of gum, you throw it away. And that's how easy it is to feel like you no longer have worth, you no longer have value. Why would it even be worth screaming out? Why would it make a difference if you're rescued? Your life still has no value. So that's her specific words. Smart was kidnapped when she was 14, and so she believed that as a rape victim, she was impure and worthless, regardless of the fact that it was not her decision. So shame for being impure keeps women from recognizing or reporting assault, whether it's marital rape and coercion or violent rape, as is the case for Elizabeth Smart. Purity culture is failure, or I guess a more apt term would be refusal to give women a vocabulary around sex, keeps them from understanding or reporting sexual assault. And it keeps them from being able to, and I want to be very careful not to position it as the victim's responsibility. It hinders us from being able to prevent it as well, because there's no explanation of varying degrees of sexual activity and consent. It's just like, sex is bad, don't do it. Well, what does sex mean? What does it include? If I say yes to making out and it escalates and we go further than I wanted to, but I said yes at the start, like, I mean, I consented to it. No, you didn't. Actually, your boundaries were pushed, but you were never taught how to have boundaries around your body, or even that you could, because, they do talk a lot about, don't give yourself to someone else. Don't let a boy XYZ, do this to you or pressure you or whatever. But there's never any language around the fact that, like, hey, you are a sovereign being and you can choose how much of yourself to sh you want to share with someone else, and when and in what way. As a sex and BDSM educator and BDSM practitioner, I talk and write a lot about consent, because it is more than just like yes or no, because sexual activity is also more than just yes or no. It's very broad and diverse. And when you're only ever given this tiny sliver and told that it is the representation of the whole of acceptable sexual behavior, it's extremely limiting and repressing. I mean, literally, it was probably like a month ago when I was on the Divorcing Religion podcast, talking about this with my friend Janice Selby, that like it clicked into place to me that I experienced sexual repression. I'm 35. Like you'd think I would have like understood that that term applied to me at some point before then, but it's just kind of like, I knew this sucked and I knew that I went through it. I knew this was going on, but like that specific label, I like my psyche had not been like, hey, you were a victim of sexual repression until like that moment for some reason.
Yeah, you know, and I remember hearing the story of Elizabeth Smart, and I get speechless every time I think about it because that is a story that literally reached national headlines. You know, and I think about stories like Gabby Petito. I think about stories like, oh God, there's so many that, you know, have gone like unheard, unseen, you know. And just thinking about that, they've just been suppressed by the algorithm. So I just, you know, I appreciate the angle that you bring everything from. And you answered that question in obviously a detailed form, but I think it was, this conversation is opening my eyes a lot and I'm learning a lot. And I know people that are listening, you know, I think they're also going to gain quite a bit out of this. And I think it's also helping people realize that, you know, I had this exact same, like, awakening, or I had this exact same moment where I was like, you know what? This is all a construct. This is all created. You know, it's all by design. And it's working exactly the way it was supposed to. It's, you know, speaking of which, we think about like our systems and how our systems fail survivors, fails marginalized communities, fails people like my mom, who's a disabled woman, who's going through cancer treatments. Like, I think about
Oh,
that. And
bro, I'm a disabled woman.
yes.
Yeah,
And
it sucks.
I think about that, and the state of where the country is right now, it is deeply devastating. This is not the country that I grew up in. Granted, I've only been on this earth for 29 years. I understand that. But that's still 29 years that I've seen this country just, you know, from my perspective, you know, from what I remember, which, what did I grow up during? I grew up during 2001, so 9/11. Going to school like that year after. That was different because it's like the world looked different before, and it looks a whole lot different now. But we're still stuck in the cycle of war. We're still stuck in the cycle of poverty and violence running rampant through our communities. And we're still stuck, unfortunately, in this capitalistic hell, but also stuck in this religious trauma world, you know, and it's so hard to shake because these practices are still here, you know, and it's still going on. And I always think that with new generations comes new ideas, but how can you have new ideas whenever these same structures are still in place? They failed our generations. They're going to fail future generations if we don't do something about it and educate why it's important to step outside of these boxes and recognize, okay, maybe everything's not so black and white. Maybe everything's not so pure. Maybe everything's not so this, not so that. But recognizing that and recognizing that gender, sexuality, religion is all a social construct, and you don't have to fall in line with any of it. You can be whoever the hell you want to be, regardless of what the Supreme Court says, regardless of what Donald Trump says, regardless of what any administration will ever say. You can be whoever you want to be. You can do whatever you want. You can love whoever you want, and without barriers. Now, obviously, do I know? Do I feel that we will ever get to that point and like as recognized by society? No, not in my lifetime. But what we can do is educate those around us and educate them about these cultures and educate them about these wrongdoings of past generations. And there's just so much to unpack and so little time to do it because it's already 2025, you know, October of 2025. And it's, yeah, we got a lot of work to do, and I recognize that. And I realize that it's far from over. Still got so much education to do, so much education to put out there, and so little people doing it too. And you know, burnout is incredibly real too in spaces like this. And you know, the education spaces, it's burnout is incredibly real.
Yeah, there's a lot to do. Oh yes, going back to like the second part of your question, like what got me into doing this. Shall we explore this avenue? Yes. So basically in the like decade post college, becoming increasingly sex positive and becoming friends with more diverse people of more diverse proclivities and relationship models outside of the narrow evangelical spectrum. Oh God, I didn't even talk about purity balls and purity pledges. Listeners, Google those on your own time. They're crazy, and they go very much hand in hand with the "your body is not your own" mindset that purity survivors or post-purity thrivers, if we want to get into like, you know, those who are healing, deal with. But I was working with a sex therapist, and I was becoming disabled from doing my corporate job. And they were like, "Hey, we actually have this program for training sex and intimacy coaches and therapists that I think you'd be a good fit for. I see that you're struggling to sustain your current career. You may want to check it out." And in the course of checking that out, I spoke with one of the earliest graduates of the Pleasure Psych program, which is what I did. And he asked me, you know, "Well, like, why do you want to get into this?" And, you know, as someone who is, you know, by that point, just generally a lot more sex positive and open and accepting of various things, and seeing how damaging purity culture had been, you know, in my own life, my own thought and behavior patterns, boundaries, et cetera, and seeing it in other people, I was like, well, I didn't have really any outside support on this journey. It was kind of just me learning things. And like I did mention, like becoming friends with more people, seeing more perspectives, especially like particularly some purity culture survivors who had become BDSM practitioners in the course of their healing. And I've actually found that there are quite a lot of post-purity people in the BDSM and kink worlds. And I talk about this a lot online and in other podcasts, but you know, I didn't really, there wasn't really like a path. And so, you know, I hadn't actually asked myself that question before. So thanks, Wayne, for asking me that. And I actually saw Wayne last night and thanked him for asking that question. And I was like, it just kind of like clicked to me. I was like, I healed from purity culture, and I got pretty fucked up by it, and I managed to unfuck myself, and I want to help other people figure it out and unfuck themselves, because it's such a difficult thing to live with. It has crazy impacts on your life as an adult. And I mean, there are people who are like in their 60s and have never had a sexual partner because they were waiting for Jesus to bring them the right, you know, their spouse, their godly spouse. So obviously this is not just something that started in the 90s, and it's not just about preserving your virginity until you get married when you're in your early 20s, which is the script that's expected generally. It's like, well, what happens if you don't? Like, you're just supposed to be celibate your entire life based on like one verse that Paul wrote to a specific scenario that was never meant to be extrapolated beyond his epistle to whichever Mediterranean first century church that was. Hang on, I gotta be angry about Paul real quick. Just gonna do that in my own head. Paul wrote most of the New Testament. Most of the New Testament is comprised of his letters to various churches in the first century. So we've got like the Gospels, and we've got the epistles, and then there's like Hebrews and Revelation, which are crazy. Nobody knows who wrote Hebrews, actually. But a lot of Paul's writing has been ex misinterpreted and inappropriately extrapolated, whether it's that or the verse about your body being a temple. That verse is actually not about virginity. It's about not being engaging in temple prostitution for a separate pagan religion while you're also trying to be part of this exclusionary monotheistic religion. But I digress. I need you to get me back on track, or I will digress about Paul for the rest of this, and that's not where I want to go. What was the question? Getting into the work. So basically, I was like, well, purity culture fucked me up. I unfucked myself. I want to help other people. And there really aren't a lot of people in the purity culture space. I think the only other like big name out there, not that I'm like a big name, but like would be Erica Smith. She founded the Purity Culture Dropout Program, which I've encountered a few people who've done it and had really good things to say. So like I'm really glad that there's some resources. She's actually publishing a book next year that's like sex ed for purity culture survivors. And I really want to read it because it's very specific. The things you have to relearn or learn for the first time as an adult when you were never allowed to engage with your body in a healthy way. Because purity culture survivors, particularly women, have a very strong disconnect with their own bodies. Because think about it, if you're told from the time you're 11 that your body is a source of temptation and lust and sin for other people, it makes it very difficult to view your body in a positive light, whether it is, about body image in general, or whether it's about exploring your body or experiencing pleasure. Because as much as female pleasure is decentered in the general society and culture in this country, it's even worse when it's coming from a religiously purity cultural environment. And the more fundamentalist your religion of origin is, the worse that's going to be. So basically, I got into the work because no one was really holding my hand through that. Except for like a couple of friends who had gone through like a little bit similar, but there weren't really a lot of resources and language and stuff. And I wanted to be there to hold people's hands as they go through this. And like, I love working with all kinds of intimacy and relational things, but the reason I got into it was because I've seen how damaging purity culture is. Like I'll talk to men who grew up in it, and they feel really distressed that they feel like they're lusting after their wives and like objectifying them. And I'm like, ah, man, that's so hard because it's like you're supposed to be sexually attracted to your partner. I mean, assuming you're both allosexual and have a libido, like that's fine. If you're asexual and you don't really have a libido or experience sexual attraction, that is also super fine. And that's also an area that the church never really touches on. Because it's weird, but a big thing for purity survivors is that like basically the aberrance of normal sexual behavior, because it's defined anything outside of that heterosexual monogamous married intercourse as aberrant. To such an extent that even when you get into a marriage, you can't engage with it because you've received so many negative messages about your body or about sex. And for women, this idea that the body is not their own, whether it's because it belongs to God or to a future spouse or what have you, makes it really difficult to engage in intimacy, even with a married partner, because you're never given any language about how to talk about what you like, what feels good to you, or even to just like be relaxed enough with your partner to for either of you to have a really good time. An example of this is vaginismus, which is a condition in which the basically like the vaginas and the pelvic floor muscles are just way too tight. You cannot have intercourse, like penetrative sexual intercourse, without pain. And it's a mix of like the physiological element, like those pelvic floor muscles being too tight, along with typically very strong levels of anxiety, whether it's conscious or subconscious. And so many women are taught that like sex is supposed to hurt. It's really not supposed to hurt, whether it's because you've got vaginismus and you don't know how to deal with that, or because your partner doesn't know that they need to get you going so that you start getting wet so you can actually self-lubricate and have like enjoyable sex, or like that you need to have time for what's called vaginal tenting, which is like when you get turned on in the cis female body, your tissue starts to expand and starts to open up so that you can actually receive some sort of thing, whether it's a toy or a finger or a penis, for like penetrative sex. And so there's these like super baseline issues and inabilities to engage with either just like your own sexual existence and desires, or being able to engage with another partner on an emotional or physiological level. And then you have like the poor boundaries and the inability to, honestly, like a lot of it comes down to consent, including self-consent, which is a concept that one of my colleagues, Jamie Azar, Erotic Expressions, wrote a piece on this recently. Self-consent is understanding what you yourself are comfortable with, whether it is how you want to engage with your body or what how you like to fantasize or touch yourself or what have you. It's about that connection with yourself, because you really can't effectively connect with other people or consent to doing things with other people if you don't understand what feels good and is okay in your own body. And like going back to that idea of consent, I think one of the big reasons that so many purity survivors gravitate toward BDSM is that it is a system that is entirely and explicitly predicated on consent. So BDSM is an acronym that stands for bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, and sadism and masochism. And that center one, dominance and submission, is this power exchange structure that comes from a place of actually, but this is something I think the mainstream does not understand. It comes from a place of mutual recognition of bodily and mental sovereignty. It's not just one person enacting their will on someone else, which honestly is often the case in religious relationships. Often there is an idea of male headship. It's very common in evangelicalism, where the man is the head of the family over his wife, over his children, etc. It's very patriarchal. And while statistically most people who identify as dominant are men, and most who like the breakdown is there are more male doms, there are more female submissives. It's coming from a place of recognizing ultimate like bodily sovereignty and consent. And the consent models that are present in BDSM are like so clearly defined. And they basically kind of encompass like three main things. Like, one, everyone has to understand what they're getting into. No lies or surprises or manipulation to get someone to agree to something they otherwise wouldn't. Two, everyone has to have the ability to refuse without consequences. No guilt tripping, arm twisting, emotional blackmail. And third, everyone has to actively agree to take part. And if your script is that, like, well, sex is just something my husband does to me, it really doesn't leave a lot on the table for you to be able to craft your own sexual experiences. And BDSM is actually not about sex. It is about power exchange, and it is about co-creating your experience. It often does include sex, because most adults have a sex drive and are basically doing this to have fun, because essentially BDSM is a container for like co-creating a game together. I'm a gamer, and well, I was before I became too disabled to play the video games with my hands. But I kind of think of power exchange and consent as like the game engine that the game of BDSM is on, and then you use the frameworks to build experiences for yourself. And there's different flavors of dominance and submission. Those kind of align with like different genres of game. And the core mechanic in this game is power exchange and role play, and defining, okay, like I gravitate towards this. This is what I like. Let's negotiate and build it together. And honestly, negotiating your relationship and your sexual experiences or your physical experiences, whether they involve sex or not, or your intimate experiences, should be part of all healthy relationships. But because they are so core in BDSM, I think it's one of the reasons that actually BDSM practitioners are some of the happiest people. There's a book that just came out called Bound by BDSM that a couple of sexological researchers did over the course of several years. And they were like, yeah, our biggest finding was that these people are really fucking happy. Like, they all have a really great sense of self and they all seem really fulfilled and happy. I think a lot of it is because there is such an emphasis on you at like you are sovereign in your body, in your decision making. You have the power to co-create an experience with someone where, in terms of power exchange, you are deliberately and intentionally identifying, I want to let you be in charge for a while. Whether it's for a single scene that you're playing out with someone, or whether it's for like an ongoing relational dynamic where you get to negotiate, hey, here's the areas where you are in charge and I don't want to be making decisions in this area or what have you. There's a lot of different ways it can look. But I think one of the core reasons that people in that lifestyle are so happy and why many people who come from purity culture gravitate toward it is because it gives us something that is not really present otherwise, particularly for the purity culture survivor for whom it's bodily autonomy and agency were just not present.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, oh gosh, this can go so much deeper, but there's a
There's so
lot,
much.
there's so much to unpack here. And there's so much, like, I remember, I'm going to tell you this. I remember the first time I walked into a gay bar, or it wasn't the first time I walked into a gay bar, but there's a couple bars that I've been in, like the upstairs, not naming any specific, but there's an upstairs that is a part of it, and it has a, well, it has a bondage shop.
Love it.
I remember my surprise. I was like, holy shit, what did I just walk into? And I hurried up and went back downstairs because I was like, oh my God. But I've always had a fascination with leather, but that's a whole different conversation. Coming from an asexual perspective, I think that's something that is definitely, oh God, that's going to open up a whole can of worms that whoo, I haven't unpacked yet necessarily. But I just remember my first time walking up there, and I looked over at my mom and I was like, did you see what I just saw? She said, yeah, let's get the fuck out of here.
Your mom was here with you at this
Yes,
place?
my mom goes to drag shows with me, or used to. I mean, she still would, but I remember her looking over and she was like, did you see what I just saw? And I said, yeah. She said, good, let's get the fuck out of here and go back downstairs.
Bet, let's go.
Oh my God, I can't get that face out of my head. The way that she looked, her eyes got so big, and she immediately turned as red as the jacket she was wearing. Like, did I just see what I think I just saw? She's
Oh
like,
my
how does
God.
somebody fit in that? And I was like, Mom, don't ask that question that you ain't ready to get the answer for, because
Actually, that's a great, don't ask the question. Don't ask that question if you're not ready for the answer. This
you
is
ain't
a
ready
big,
for the answer, do not ask that question. Just don't.
this is actually a core part of like sexual education is something called the Plicit model, where you're providing like providing limited information, PLI, to meet whoever you're talking with, kind of like where they're at, and provide them with like appropriate information. Like, I don't go into a session with someone and be like, oh, you come from purity culture, you want to go to a dungeon? No, I'm like, okay. Where are you at in your exploration? How do you feel about your body? Have you had sex? How do you feel about the concept of it? Like, tell me where you're at right now. And I have like an intake for people to, give me some sexual history information so that we come in and I'm able to meet where they're at and provide answers to questions that they are ready for.
Exactly, and that's actually the first time I've shared that story about my mom, because oh my God, it was so funny. I cannot get the face out of my head. I keep thinking about it, and oh God, I'm really thinking about it. But anyway, at least she hasn't been back since, by the way. Yeah, she's traumatized to the core. That's not the reason she hasn't been back, but that's a different story for a different episode. But we just ran into somebody that we really didn't want to run into, and that's definitely a trauma past.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I appreciate you coming on the podcast today and taking us through this journey and this education. And I think these are the conversations we need to continue having to break these cycles of these cultures, break these cycles of violence, break these cycles of just all these social constructs. And we're still stuck in this cycle, and it's going to continue going until we recognize we need to break these cycles. But is there anything
Yeah.
else you wanted to share with anybody who may be listening? And how can people find you on social media and find out more about your work?
Yeah. I think the main thing that I always want to highlight is that your body is your own, and you do have the power to say yes or no. But specifically, purity culture survivors, specifically women, it is okay to say yes to sex. We're often not really given that permission. And consent is so much more than just, not letting a boy feel you up on a date or what have you. It is a whole framework of interacting with the world, and we do have the power to define how we do that. And I can be found on my website is intimacylacey.com. That's LACEY. I do free consults. I'm going to start doing some free like office hours for like specific questions. I'm on Instagram and TikTok under at intimacylacey. And right now, in October, I started a series called Vampire Sex Ed, where I read insane bullshit people were told in sex ed, except I'm in a vampire costume because I had done a photo shoot earlier that day and I didn't want the effort to go to waste. So if you want to hear and watch me lisp my way through some crazy abstinence only sex ed bullshit, that's going to be going up on my Instagram the rest of the month and also my TikTok. Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you so much, my friend, for coming on the podcast today. And let you take care of yourself, and I will talk to you very soon.
All right, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Take it easy, okay?
Cheers.